Rewind to the Living Dead is brought to you by Germ Death Hand Sanitizer, the only hand sanitizer with 66.6% ethyl alcohol, kills 99.9% of germs, and smells real good doing it too. So you can check them out at germdeath.com. Visit them at Facebook and Instagram at Germ Death. Rewind to the Living Dead is also brought to you by reanimatedrecords.com, your place for movies. That's Blu-rays, DVDs, VHS tapes. They got that. There's music, vinyl, CDs, cassette tapes. You name it, they got it. Vintage, new, used, all that kind of cool stuff. Cool t-shirts from bands, from horror films, posters, action figures. You name it, they got it at reanimatedrecords.com. Fair warning, Rewind to the Living Dead is a review show, so spoilers are ahead.
Hardcore film fanatics probably already know the name Sono Shion from his many works in Japan, where he's been hailed as one of the most idiosyncratic artists of his generation. From films such as Suicide Club to Love Exposure, Shion had a reputation for grotesque violence, extreme eroticism, surreal images, and complex narratives. In 2018, Shion planned his first overseas production with an English-language film that would star Nicolas Cage, who described the project as the wildest movie I've ever done. The original script for the film was actually written as a more straightforward action film, but Shion had to add his own personal touches, which the director says added a little bit of weirdness. The film is set against a dystopian society ruled over by a ruthless governor who sends Cage's character out into a nuclear wasteland to retrieve his granddaughter, which is a code name for one of his sex slaves.
My granddaughter has been lost to us. I would have her return to me post-haste. And you, sir, I am told, are the man to do the job. Each arm is equipped with an explosive device. Your trousers are also equipped with explosives.
Really?
Just beyond the point where we now stand lies a highway where evil reigns.
What is this?
At the end of 5 days, if you have not returned with Benice, well, I think you get the idea, son. Godspeed.
This is the Ghostland, a land of no escape. We are not the ones who hold her captive. It's been 2 days, and still she is missing.
I get out of here.
You must surrender to fate.
Make it rain, baby! Yeah.
I am radioactive.
No one escapes the Ghostland.
I'm not a prisoner!
In the latest episode of Rewind of the Living Dead, we're going to check the explosive strapped to our bodies and grab a samurai sword as we review the 2021 sci-fi fever dream known as Prisoners of the Ghostland. Welcome back to Rewind of the Living Dead. I'm Damon Martin.
And I'm Patrick Guerra.
And Patrick, this week I have got a little bit of acid in my spam because we are going to review one of the most bizarre movies, quite possibly since we did the lost episode of Bloodbeat, which will eventually come out, I promise. We're going to review one of Nicolas Cage's latest films, The Prisoners of the Ghostland. And boy, oh boy.
Boy, oh boy. It's so weird how cohesive the trailer sounds, like just listening to the trailer play. And I'm going, man, they're like, I know what the story is. Then you watch Prisoners of the Ghostland and you're like, how does anyone do this without massive amounts of drugs? I have to assume drugs are a big part of it. I'm not a big drug guy. I don't really take a lot of drugs. So I'm like, how do you do this? How do these visions come into your mind? Because Prisoners of the Ghostland is what you said, like this fever dream, I don't even know. It's otherworldly. And you don't know how somebody comes up with shit like this.
It's funny you say that. I was actually going to mention that watching or listening to the trailer, and even watching the trailer when I got this ready last night for today's episode, I was like, watching it, listening to it, this sounds like a pretty cohesive, like, you know, pretty straightforward story, like kind of a cool story. And I'll be honest, when I read the synopsis for the movie, and I remember Bill Moseley, the great Bill Moseley, who I adore, one of my favorite horror actors in general, but just horror actors of all time. I follow him on Twitter and social media and everything, and he was, you know, kind of promoting this when it was coming out, and I was like, Bill Moseley, Nicolas Cage, I'm in. You know, this sounded like, and the concept sounded, you know, cool enough, like a ruthless, you know, governor who is played by Bill Moseley sends Nicolas Cage's character out into a dystopian wasteland to retrieve his granddaughter. Okay, that sounds like a pretty straightforward idea. The film is anything but that.
It's anything but that. We should kind of get into first and foremost, like, this is a Nicolas Cage movie. Now, this year, I've been kind of high on Nicolas Cage because I've told you many times off the air, I love the movie Pig that will, I hope, get a couple of nominations this year for the Oscars. It's a really great, really serious movie that stars Nicolas Cage. It's a great dramatic performance. But truth be told, Damon, Nicolas Cage has had quite a few years now where he's kind of been doing really offbeat, very different, very weird horror films. Like there's like sort of a Nicolas Cage horror genre. And I mean, for those of you who are a little bit younger that listen to this show, in the 1980s and 90s, Nicolas Cage was as big an actor as like George Clooney. He was like a serious
he's an Oscar winner. He's an Oscar winner.
He is an Oscar winner. I mean, he's done huge movies, like big movies, over his career. I know he fell in some financial trouble. I think he owed like tens of millions or hundreds of millions to the IRS, some crazy number. He'd spent his money extravagantly, and he spent the 2000s up until now, making very strange films. In the last, I would say, I don't know, decade, he's kind of focused on just making weird horror films, and Prisoners of Ghostland, I don't know if it's the weirdest because I haven't seen them all, but it's got to be up there.
Yeah, it's weird because I've always been a Nicolas Cage fan. Let me be clear about that. Like, when he won his Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas, that's a pretty incredible film and a pretty incredible performance from him and Elizabeth Shue. It's a great movie. And that kind of that was almost like his, in a way, like his, he had done a lot of goofy comedies and kind of of course he did Raising Arizona, which is an all time classic, but he wasn't like an A-list guy. And then he does, you know, Leaving Las Vegas, wins the Oscar, and then suddenly he becomes like an action star. He does Face Off, a John Woo movie, which is a classic. He does Con Air, which, you know, is a guilty pleasure movie of mine. I'm not going to deny that. He does City of Angels, a romantic comedy, whatever, with Meg Ryan. So he's like an A-list, like you said, as A-list as you can get. He does the remake of Gone in 60 Seconds with Angelina Jolie. I mean, he is as big a star and as big a draw in terms of films as anybody in Hollywood at that point. And then you mentioned his financial issues. And then I don't know what changed that led him to all these kind of weird roles. But then, you know, when he did Mandy, and I think it was 2018 or 2017, when that film came out, that kind of got him, like, he had done a lot of movies before that were very forgettable, kind of like straight to video. No one really saw it. And when they did see it, they're kind of like, what in the hell is going on here? But then he did Mandy, which ended up being a bit of a critical hit. It wasn't a huge commercial success until it got out on Shudder and other, you know, services like that. But Mandy kind of, in a way, reminded people how good Nicolas Cage could be, even in this kind of oddball role. And then he goes on to do Color Out of Space and Willy's Wonderland, which came out last year. And of course, this one, Prisoners of the Ghostland. And listen, you know, I'm with you. I was a late arriver to Pig, which was one of my top five films of last year, just like outside of horror, like one of my top five favorite movies of 2021. So I really loved his performance in Pig. And I'm a Nicolas Cage fan. So I'm all for him going outside the norm to do these roles, because this is not something that I would imagine. You said George Clooney, but anybody of that level that would do these kind of films, like, I just wouldn't imagine they would. So yeah, I applaud.
Mean, it's almost like The Rock. When you list off his movies, I mean, it's closer to The Rock almost. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so I would applaud him for taking these chances and doing it. But man, oh man! And listen, Patrick, I'm a film fan, and I know you are much more of what I would call, I don't mean this is an insult, I mean it's a compliment, because everyone's got their own thing, like an art movie fan, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
I'm not as much. Now, I do like some, I mean, you know, there's definitely, you know, the quote-unquote art films that I've enjoyed, but I'll be completely honest, I'm not a huge art film guy, and I know you are, but this one was an art film set as a sci-fi, like dystopian sci-fi, kind of a horror film, I guess. And I was just like, jaw gaped, like mouth gaped, jaw on the floor, and not necessarily in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we got through the plot easy enough there. Like you said it, and you go, okay, well, then what's so hard to figure out, guys? The structure of this film, and we should probably talk about the director a little bit, Sono Shian, I think is how you said his name is pronounced. He, in his own right, is a very well-known, very well-regarded art house director from Japan. He's the kind of guy, like, I think he was a poet first, and then he just decided to flip into film. And he's made some really, really avant-garde stuff over the years. Stuff that even goes beyond, I think, art house and into just something different. I think of like Jodorowsky, Nicholas Winding Refn is like a new version of that. People who just do things that are really out there. Although I think Nicholas Winding Refn is a little more straightforward. Sono Shian does like really, really, really out there stuff. And he said that this is the craziest movie he's ever done. Nicolas Cage says this is the craziest movie I've ever done. It's crazy. It's weirdly coherent if you follow its rules, but if you're not ready for it, like my wife wasn't, she saw the trailer and she was like, okay, yeah, I'll watch this. And then like 10 minutes in, she's like, I'm out. I don't know what the fuck this is. Like, I'm going to bed. 'Cause it's nutty. And it's just, the aesthetics are all over the place. I mean, did you ever understand what time frame we were in?
No, not at all.
Did you ever understand why there were cowboys and samurais together?
None whatsoever. Not whatsoever. No.
Yeah. I mean, I could kind of glean that there was some, that we're living in a post-apocalyptic world. I don't know why. It didn't really matter. That part really didn't bother me, but it was like, it was this mashup of things. And then there was an incredible scale, Damon, to this movie. Like, he built some really, really, really large set pieces. Like there's a town boulevard, like, but it's old world, but also new.
It's called Samurai Town. That's actually the name of the town they live in, Samurai Town.
Yeah, it's a mashup of like the old West and like new Tokyo and post apocalypse. It's really confusing. I mean, I was impressed by actually how intricate the movie was, and you mentioned before. Before the podcast, it kind of had Terry Gilliam vibes. And I was like right there with you. It was in my notes. I was like, this is very Terry Gilliam-esque in terms of how they structure this film. But man, does the plot go fucking sideways fast.
Yeah. So if you don't know Terry Gilliam, as I mentioned before the show, because I said it to Patrick before, and I was like, do you know who Terry Gilliam is? Just to make sure, because I was going to bring it up here, because when I was watching it, I was like, this reminds me so much of a Terry Gilliam film. Terry Gilliam, for those out there that aren't like hardcore film fans, Terry Gilliam directed 12 Monkeys, which was a film that got Brad Pitt, you know, an Oscar back in the day for supporting actor. That was probably one of his more, you know, straightforward films, even though that one's definitely out there as well. He did Zero Theorem, which is a completely bizarre movie. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, of course, about Hunter Thompson, which You know, if you're any kind of a rock and roll fan, you've probably heard the name Hunter Thompson and know that that guy was on pretty much every drug that's ever been taken. Like him and Keith Richards are like a, you know, standing eight count for who did the most drugs in that period of time. So Terry Gilliam is very much, and I said this to you last night. I said, I think David Lynch would watch this movie and say, what the fuck? Because I've said this, like when we talk about the art house movies, I've said many times, like I am a massive David Lynch fan, and David Lynch is about as far out there as you can get in terms of weirdness. And I've said, I can't explain it. I was a huge Twin Peaks fan. I can't explain my just adoration for David Lynch, because typically David Lynch would fall into the same category where I'm just like, I tune out. I just don't get it. But I love his films. Maybe it's the performances he brings out of his actors. Don't want to get too far off base, but I love David Lynch. But that's as weird as I go, and I understand that is definitely on the weirder end of the scale. But, and again, I credit anybody for making a film with their own vision. You know, you and I are working on a script right now, and we've said many, many times, like, it would be weird for us to have anyone else carry out this vision, because we have it so ingrained in our heads of what something should look like. And I credit, you know, Sono Cheyenne for making a film the way he wants, but good Lord, I mean, just, I mean... Let me give you the example where this just went completely off the rails for me, because at the beginning of this film, and the film's been out for I think a year now, so I know we're going to get right into spoilers, so you know I'm not really holding back on this one. The beginning of the movie launches with Nicolas Cage and a friend of his robbing a bank, and it looks like the friend is going to actually shoot a kid, which causes Nicolas Cage to react. We don't see the end of that scene until later, and so Nicolas Cage ends up getting arrested, and then he ends up getting pulled out of his cage by this sadistic governor played by the great Bill Moseley. And Bill Moseley tasks him with going out into this wasteland called Ghostland to retrieve his granddaughter who had escaped, which again, we don't know at the time. Well, you kind of figure it out pretty quickly that his quote unquote granddaughter are actually his sex slaves. But he sends him out there to retrieve his granddaughter, and he straps him with all these explosives, basically all these different rules of if you do this, all you know, you get blown up. If you do this, you get blown up. If you take too long to come back, you get blown up. And where it went completely off the rails was right after this. They give Nicolas Cage a car. He drives out a little bit. Just
wait,
stop.
Hold on. Before we get to that part, you said when it really goes off the rails. Here's where it goes off the rails. When he puts on the suit, it's got these explosive devices in very specific spots. Two of which are for each of his testicles.
Yes.
And then Nicolas Cage walks to that car with glowing testicle explosives. And I go, he didn't just go, I'm out. He didn't just take the suit off and walk off set. He kept going. But anyway, go ahead, because he gets to the car,
drives like 5 feet, jumps out, runs furiously over and grabs a bike with a basket on it and starts pedaling out into the wasteland. And then they eventually bring the car back to him, make him take the car. I watched that scene when he runs out and grabs the bicycle, and he has this like this look of like manic, like this manic look on his face, and he's riding this bicycle. And at that moment, I think that's when I text you. I was like, "What in the hell am I watching right now? Like, what is going on?"
Yeah, like up to that point, the movie is sort of it's like two worlds. It's like the governor's world and Nicolas Cage's backstory, and then it's just kind of. It's Sono Cheyenne just sort of showing you this weird world. There's a lot of like song and dance, and it's kind of actually unsettling in its own way. I put that in my notes, like something about the unexplained singing from the crowds did lend itself to some dread, because I was like, I don't understand what's happening. Like you talk about fear is all about the unknown. I didn't know shit. So it started to kind of come into focus when Bill Moseley tasks this prisoner, this bad guy with getting his granddaughter back, and then it just goes right off the rails again. And he crashes the car, by the way. Once they make him get off the bike, get back in the car, he drives like a maniac for, I don't know, less than a minute, and then crashes and then completely knocks himself out and is like out of the car and like face down in rubble for like I don't know however long. It doesn't make any sense.
It's just really weird. I mean, I don't know a better way to describe it. Like at that moment I was kind of like, because the concept sounded straightforward enough, and I guess I should have known better, But I just went in thinking, okay, this sounds like a pretty straightforward concept. And, you know, again, not the most complex plot, but I'm a big believer in don't make it harder than it has to be. You know, right. People sometimes they feel like, whether we're talking about horror movies or just movies in general, I think they overcomplicate a plot for the sake of making it complicated, you know, and it takes me out of a film sometimes when they do that, whether that's just a plot twist or just the general plot, you know, of itself. And so I was just thinking, this sounds pretty straightforward. He's going down into a wasteland to retrieve this guy's granddaughter. And that sounded, you know, easy enough. And then everything just goes so far out into left field, out of the ballpark, down the river. I mean, it's just
up and, the river.
And listen, I understand a big part of these kind of films is visuals and symbolism. I get that. Yeah. I'm not idiotic enough to understand what, at least to some level, Sono Cheyenne is doing here with the visuals and the symbolism. That being said, while I do appreciate symbolism in films and television, especially when, you know, you get a great message out of, you know, whether we're talking about, like, let's say a Marvel film or even a horror film, you know, you talk about, like, you know, you talk about just great horror films that have, like, a really, like, a strong social message, social commentary, whatever it is. And you can tell, I mean, again, I know it's more obvious, but I think of, like, a film that, like, Get Out, which is, you know, an all-time classic. That film is a little more, you know, straightforward with the message it's trying to get across, but there's still some subtleties in there, and it's a great film while also kind of teaching you a really, really harsh lesson in reality of racism and things like that. And again, that one's, of course, again, more, you know, directly in your face, although there are still some subtleties in that movie, but I appreciate a film that has something to say. I really do. But there's other times when I watch, and that's why I say I'm not a big art house movie fan, when I watch some films and I get done watching it, and if I just, there's really no plot, or the plot doesn't make sense, or again, they overcomplicate it, I just lose. And so basically once Nicolas Cage gets out into the ghost land, out into the wasteland, and he meets this other society of people who are, I mean, weird doesn't even begin to describe it. I tune out. And again, I'm not, if you are a fan of these kind of like these, you know, these weird fever dreams, I don't know a better way to say it, then you might love this film. And I'm not telling anyone not to watch it, of course, go watch it. But I'm saying, like, I actually hope people will watch this and see what they think. Yeah. But like, as soon as it got to that point in the film, I kind of tuned out because I was just like, what is this? Like, I didn't understand it. And I actually read a couple of interviews and articles afterwards with Sono Cheyenne and just, you know, people critiquing the film, and it made me understand it a little bit better, but still at the end I was kind of like, what was this?
You talk about like things you can learn from a film. What I learned from this film is I need to take way more drugs. If Manhunter, which we reviewed on this show, was clearly fueled by cocaine in the 1980s, this movie's fueled by like acid, ketamine, DMT, angel dust, you know, a random bottle of pills in mom's cupboard. I mean, it's really all over the place. It creates really inventive visuals. And if I'm really honest, the story itself isn't that hard to follow. It's just, it's these strange divergences. Now, when he gets to Ghostland, so this is the outside world, the world outside of Samurai Town. He gets to Ghostland, and Ghostland is a bunch of people around these ruins of a giant clock, and they all this all seems very post-apocalyptic. Now I'm in the post-apocalypse, and there's these people wrapped up in like doll parts, which I thought was kind of creepy. I don't know about you, that seemed pretty creepy to me. Well, let's see, I never quite understood why they were there. I did read up on it later, which I'm not even going to talk about it here because I think people should experience it the way they experience it. But the explanation that I read later on never seemed to line up with what I was watching on the screen. I never quite understood why those people were – time was a big theme, and I don't know why. Like I love theme in films. Time was certainly a strong theme in this film, but I don't know why it was important. Did you pick up on why time was so important?
So I didn't pick up on it at the time, but afterwards, reading some interviews, I did read an interview where it did start to make, where it, well, I won't say make sense, but it explained
they
it.
Say, they start explaining it to you, which, I don't know, seems like a failure, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, because when I read it, I was kind of like, okay, it kind of makes sense now, didn't make sense at the time. I could watch it 10 more times, and unless I knew that, I would never figure it out. So again, I'm telling you this only because I'd be shocked if anyone actually figured this out watching it. So apparently the symbolism of the clock is that it was trying to prevent another, what was the nuclear meltdown in Japan from the, Fukushima? Fukushima. Yeah, Fukushima.
No, oh, the nuclear meltdown. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
They were trying to stop the clock from going forward to prevent another Fukushima from happening, was the explanation I read
online. Wow. Really didn't pick up that.
100% did not pick up on that. So that's why they were stopping the clock, because they didn't want another nuclear fallout. That was the excuse I read online, and I was like, okay, I guess, but when you make it so obscure that, you know, I couldn't pick up any of that. Like, I understood they were trying to, like, do something with that clock, had something to do with time, and they were seemingly trapped there. All that made sense, but everything else surrounding it made zero sense and just lost me. And I'm not the audience for this movie. I'm being honest about that right up front. Now, I don't know what the audience is. I don't know if the audience is people who really enjoy LSD, but there are people who love these kind of weird, you know, again, symbolism, fever dream, whatever you want to call it. The Lynchian mob, so to speak. Not the Lynch mob, not the great rap group. Lynchian mob. Maybe that's who it's for. But again, when you make a movie that's so out there to the point where I can't even really follow along. And I don't need it to be a straight line. Trust me. I don't need it to be a straight line. I can zigzag and get back to where I want to go. But when it's so obscure to the point, and like I said, once he got to Ghostland, I tuned out because it was just so weird. And there's like these weird interpretive dances. And there's this group led by a character called Ratman. And they speak in like a monotone, almost like it sounds like you're speaking on a VHS cassette, like from like the 80s. Yeah. Like the soundtrack changed, like the track sound of the film changed. And then
they were full like post-apocalyptic cyberpunks.
And then one other thing that kind of took, and you're going to laugh at this, and I know I texted you about this last night, but I'm serious. And I love Nicolas Cage. I have zero problem with anyone out there, as you get a little older or whatever, you want to dye up your hair, you don't want to look, you know, you want gray, I get all that. Yeah. But how much did they spend on black hair dye for Nicolas Cage and his beard in this movie? Because good Lord, it was so unnerving watching him with her walk around with that hair and that beard. I was just like, what? Like, why? Like, couldn't they afford like a hairstylist to actually do it properly? Because it literally looked like he put one of those like out of the box hair dye jobs on his beard and his hair. And it was just like this weird, really off. Like, it was just so bizarre. Yeah.
He's very focused on that, because I actually watched like an actors roundtable for this year's like Oscar hopefuls, and he was on it, and the hair dye is still there. He's very serious. He doesn't like people seeing that he went gray. In Pig, he's gray, and it's looks kind of distinguished. I go, you know, I think he should embrace that, but he doesn't want to. Okay, that's
fine.
His preference.
That's fine.
That's fine. I mean, I'm covered in tattoos, right? I'm not into my normal skin, so I get it. But it is like, man, you know, maybe fire the person that's doing it for you and hire somebody who can do it really well. Because I'm not knocking the hair dye. Go ahead, do it. Just do it well.
Yeah, that was, I'm with you on that. And listen, I'm no style critic. Trust me. I'm sure there's a lot of people look at me and say, I can't dress myself. But yeah, that was so weird to me. And just like, but again, once they get to Ghostland and he's trying to rescue Bernice, who is played by Sophia Boutella, who of course people might know from The Mummy, the less memorable Mummy starring Tom Cruise. It goes so far out of the way to be weird, and just at that point, it just loses me. Everything from then on out pretty much lost me. And then they eventually get back to Samurai Town after he rescues Bernice, and the plan is to bring in the dystopian people living in Ghostland so they could start to survive again in Samurai Town. And so he goes back there, and that's where another big battle sets out, where essentially Nicolas Cage is trying to stop the governor and Bernice is trying to stop from being, you know, put back into sexual servitude. All that makes sense. And again, the ending of the film, the action scenes and everything aren't bad, actually. They aren't terrible, but they're pretty fun. But that whole middle section, literally every moment they're in Ghostland, I'm just like, stop the ride. I want to get off.
Well, how about this, Damon? So, if you're listening at home and you're going, guys, let's get to the horror. It's really hard to get to because I don't think there's horror in this movie in that respect. It's weird because it was on Shudder. That's how we found it. Hey, Shudder, what's going on? Because it doesn't seem like a horror film. There is like this one element where they keep teasing this group of, I would say, nuclear mutants on an atomic bus from hell. And you go, oh, okay, that's where the horror is going to come from. And even at one point, there's like this mutant attack that's very reminiscent of like a zombie attack. Like, so you go, oh, okay, well, here's where all the horror is. And then it kind of just fades away. And then it comes back, and then it fades away, and then it comes back. And the only thing it turns out, the only thing that turns out to be important from that is that the leader of those you know, nuclear mutants is Nicolas Cage's old partner, actually, who's played by Nick Cassavetes, who's in his own right a great character actor.
And a bit of a Looney Tune, if we're being honest.
Oh, yeah, he's a bit nutty. And but they're like, you know, they're all melted and kind of horrific looking. So that's kind of where I think the horror was supposed to be in this movie. But I was so disappointed that the showdown with the nuclear mutants and Nick Cage and his group was really just them walking up to each other and talking and going, hey, man, sorry about the past. And that was the end of it. Yeah. I was like, what? Like, we're so close to the horror part of this movie. We're not going to get it. And he's like, they're like, nope, you're not going to get it at all.
Yeah. I'll give credit. The effects of the psycho of Psycho, who is his name, but also like the nuclear mutants. It looks good. Like, they're visually pretty cool.
Honestly, I was really blown away by the production design of this movie because it doesn't seem like it's a big budget. Like, I'm guessing they were repurposing some movie lots that are already there in Japan. It looks like they probably built the Ghostland set itself, like where the big clock tower is and everything like that. But I think the production design of this movie was actually pretty good. It's just the storytelling makes me wish that I did watch movies while I was high. I don't ever do that. I really don't ever do that. But a lot of people go, oh, man, you got to see this, but you better be smoked out, man. It'll be amazing. I watched Ghostland, Prisoners of the Ghostland, and thought, yeah, if I watched this super high, I bet I would go crazy for it.
And did you hear about the casting and the production change in this movie? I want to bring that up real quick before we get to our category.
Yeah, go for it. Tell them.
Originally, this film was going to be shot in, where was it going to be shot in?
Mexico.
Mexico. And then Sono Shion had a heart attack. And so Nicolas Cage basically said, we're going to move the entire production over to Japan so it could be closer to home for him to make it easier for the director to actually be there for the filming, which, again, pretty cool. Originally, the film was going to star Ed Skrein, who a lot of people might remember from Deadpool. He was also in Game of Thrones briefly for basically the end of one season where he played one of the he was hooked up with Emilia Clarke's character, and then he was the bad guy in the first Deadpool movie. He was in there, and then originally Imogen Poots was going to play the role that Sofia Boutella played. When they moved the production to Japan, both of them dropped out and ended up being Sofia Boutella and I can't remember what part Ed Skrein. Oh, he was going to Nick Cassavetes' part. He was going to play Psycho, right. and then Nick Cassavetes stepped in there. So I credit Nicolas Cage for being a leader and doing this. And, you know, again, I don't think the vision was sacrificed. Good Lord, I can only imagine if it was when they actually did this film in Japan. But it's interesting how this thing got made. And you know, Nicolas Cage, I know we kind of talked about it. Listen, Nicolas Cage's second act, as I'm calling it, listen, I'm all for it, and I'm glad this guy's experimenting and doing things he loves. And I actually watched part of that same roundtable you're talking about where he talked about one time he got chucked off a horse. I was watching that. Kind of made me laugh. But I'm a Nicolas Cage, and I'm all for this Nicolas Cage second act. I'm just saying the Prisoners of the Ghostland was just so out there that it was hard to follow. And when it was over, I was just like, what did I just watch?
But it weirdly does make me want to watch all these other weird Nicolas Cage. I've seen Mandy, and this makes Mandy look like a straightforward thriller.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm sure a lot of the people that listen to this show have watched Mandy and they're like, oh, wow, Mandy's a crazy acid trip. It's like, dude, it has nothing on this movie in terms of how weird it is. But it actually makes me appreciate Mandy because I'm actually not that big on Mandy. I don't think it's the greatest Nicolas Cage movie out there. Some people are like, dude, it's the best. And I'm like, it's good. It's just not like my cup of tea, but it's pretty good. Prisoners of Ghostland is so far out there, so crazy. It's like an anime come to life. That's really what I think I was getting the vibes off that a lot. It's like certain animes, like it's hard. I'm not a big anime guy. It's hard for me to get into it, but every now and then I'll take a peek at one and it's like super weird and things don't make sense quite. They don't quite make sense. It doesn't quite make sense why certain characters are the way they are. Whatever. Prisoners of the Ghostland is really far out there, and it makes me want to watch a movie like Color Out of Space, which won a ton of awards at the Fangoria Awards that we covered. It makes me want to watch the Willy's Wonderland or whatever, which I heard is insane. And I heard Nicolas Cage doesn't even have a line of dialogue in Willy's Wonderland. So I'm like, well, I want to fucking see what all this shit is about. Like I am weird like that, right? Because I am the art house guy of the two of us. I can't say that like I loved this movie, but I can say like it piqued my interest. I want to see all these oddball, weird Nicolas Cage movies now.
No, yeah, I'm with you on that. And I liked Mandy. I'm with you. I didn't think it was the greatest thing ever, but I did enjoy it. And I, you know, I am interested to see some of these other films just for that reason. I know that, again, he's got a lot of critical acclaim within the horror community for kind of taking these big swings. And you know, again, when you take big swings, sometimes you hit a home run, sometimes you strike out. I'm not saying there's, again, when I keep going back to the odd nature of Prisoners of the Ghostland, there are elements that I enjoyed or laughed at or whatever, but again, the story and the plot was just so hard to follow that, and I've said this on the show 1,000 times, plot and story are always what matter most to me. I can look past even a bad performance if it's a really good story, strong dialogue, all those kind of things. When you lose me on that, I just kind of tune out a little bit, and that's kind of where I'm at. Now, again, if you are a Nicolas Cage fan, you liked Color Out of Space, you loved Mandy, all those kind of things, you're probably going to really enjoy this film. I'm being honest. Like, if you're really, really into Nicolas Cage's second act and you really dig all the things he's been doing lately, this is right in line with that. I don't think it's that far out of, even though he called it his wildest movie, I don't think it's that far out of the realm of anything else he's been doing. But again, I'm just not that guy. And again, I'm not the audience they were probably trying to play to in the first place, even though it's technically a sci-fi horror-ish film. With that being said, Patrick, we do have a lot of categories to get to, and this is going to be a lot of fun to talk about some of these categories because, boy, oh boy. So let's get into it and kick things off as we do each and every week here on the show with Best Performance. So when you watch Prisoners of the Ghostland, who was your best performance?
My best performance actually came from a character that they call Yasujiro, played by Tak Sakaguchi. He's a samurai, basically. And I feel like if I could best understand him, I think he was the lead bodyguard of the governor. Am I getting that right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Okay, I think. It's hard to tell. But he plays a very stoic character, and I don't know that he has any lines, actually. He might have one or two lines in the whole movie. But his stoicism came across really well. Like, it was clear he was like a noble warrior in this land of outlaws. And he has a bunch of great scenes. He's clearly one of the I think they imply in the movie that he is the only equal warrior wise to Nicolas Cage's character, which is, by the way, called Hero. Most people don't you don't ever really get to know his name. But yeah, I like Tak Sakaguchi for what he did, because in a movie where the performances were like at a 15, he was playing it at right at like 7, and it hit really well. Like it was a great contrast to everything I was watching.
It's funny you say that, because my best performance, and I assume you probably went into this thing, and it's got to be Bill Moseley.
I wasn't sure.
Damon's the biggest Bill Moseley fan in the world. And you're right. I am a massive Bill Moseley fan, but I actually didn't give him best performance. I actually gave my best performance to Sophia Boutella. And you know why? Do you want to know why, Patrick?
Please.
Because I'm pretty sure she was acting in a movie that she was being the straight man, so to speak. Like, she was being the serious actor in a movie that did not require her to be a serious actor. Like, she was was doing a different movie than everybody else on set. Like, Sophia Boutella's performance is like very emotional and very like straightforward and very like, you know, like she has a very serious role, and it's so far away from what everybody else is doing in this movie. Like, I feel like they handed out like, you know, LSD pancakes at breakfast, and she's like, no, I don't eat gluten. So she's the one who didn't get it. And so I give credit to where credit's due. Sophia Boutella was like the straight man in this movie. She was in a different movie than everybody else. She was in the movie I think we thought we were getting. She was in the movie that sounds like the trailer. She was like very like to the point. She didn't get out there and go wackadoo with her performance. And so in that regard, I was like, you know what? Acting against some really oddball performances, she played it kind of straight. I was like, good for you, Sophia Boutella.
You know exactly who she reminds me of? John Vernon in Killer Clowns from Outer Space played like the grizzled cop.
Oh yeah,
that had seen it all. He was in a hard-boiled thriller, and Killer Clowns from Outer Space is an absolute clown show. Like it's ridiculous. But he was playing it as straight as he was in a Dirty Harry movie.
Yeah,
that's what Sophia Boutella was doing in this movie.
Yeah,
like she was doing a dramatic, like I'm a prisoner of, you know, of the sex trade, and I'm trying to get my way out. She played it dead straight, and it was good. I almost picked her, and it wasn't her fault that I didn't end up picking her. It was just like some of the lines they give her were kind of weird, and I was like, okay, like it wasn't her fault. And we've said this before, that bad performances actually really aren't 99% of the time. They're not actually bad performances. It's just what's written for the character. And that was the case for her, in my opinion. But just a little side note, since we're talking about weird avant-garde movies, a really weird, strange avant-garde movie that I like out there, if you haven't seen it, that stars Sophia Boutella, is called Climax by Gaspard Noé. And Gaspard Noé is a very avant-garde French-Belgian filmmaker. Climax, she's the star of. It's a super weird movie. The credits roll three times before the movie ends. That's how weird the movie is. Check her out in that. If you like stuff like this and you haven't seen Climax, check out Climax.
Yeah, I do know the director's name, but I have not seen that film. But yeah, she like I said, if they remade this movie and made it to the point of the trailer where it was just like that, you know, going out into a dystopian wasteland to rescue, you know, this girl and bring her back to the governor, or whatever. She was playing in that movie. She was not playing whatever it was that Sono Shion was doing.
We should also talk about a little bit about Nicolas Cage's performance. I mean, he didn't make either of our lists, but let's be honest, he's become sort of a meme these days for his really out there wild performances. This was no different. If you haven't seen Prisoners of the Ghostland and you're into wacky, weird Nicolas Cage performances, this is one of them.
Yeah, his performance is something else, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later because I do have something, trust me. Okay. With that being said, let's talk about favorite character, because there were a lot of characters in this movie. Patrick, who was your favorite character in Prisoners of the Ghostland?
Yeah, this movie is rich with characters, and actually there are a lot of opportunities to go, oh, I like that one, or oh, I like that one. My favorite character was Ratman. Ratman was part of the prisoners of the Ghostland, that weird post-apocalyptic world. Again, like kind of like they were kind of like Mad Max guys, but they were also like tinged with this weird techno thing. Like they spoke through, even though they didn't, they just talked, but their voices sounded like they were speaking through an old radio or something. It was really cool. I just liked the design of it, and it very much reminded me of a Terry Gilliam movie, like the Ratman and his crew. They could work on all the cars and all that stuff. They were working on crazy big rig trucks. You know, that's a very specific style that they have in Japan. They had those trucks there. I really liked Ratman. Like, it was just – anytime he was on screen, it looked cool, it sounded cool, and it was, you know, batshit weird, but that, you know, that was par for the course.
Can I ask a question about Ratman in relation to the plot? So later in the film, Nicolas Cage – tries to convince the quote-unquote prisoners of the Ghostland that they can escape and they can have like a life outside of this dystopian wasteland. If I'm getting this correct. And at one point he tells Ratman to go fix all these vehicles, all these things that they had around to get ready and drive out of there. Right after he does this, Ratman fixes up these cars, which are shiny and new, which makes no sense, but that's neither here nor there. And then Nicolas Cage decides to borrow gas from him to put in his wrecked car so he could drive back. So what was the point of fixing all the other freaking cars if he's going to just put gas in his wrecked car to drive back? I was so confused by that.
Yeah, he's got these giant big rigs that look like rolling Las Vegas casinos. And then he chooses to just take a gallon of gas and put it in his busted-ass Toyota Celica.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, well, I don't know why that, why we did that. Yeah. I think Sono Shion and the other writer is, oh shit, where's his name? It's Reza Sikso Safai. I think they wrote everything and they were like, everything's staying in. Even if we can't shoot it. Okay, well, we can't shoot a bunch of trucks, you know, charging towards Samurai Town. Okay, great. So should we take it out of the script? Nah, we'll leave it in. It's fine.
I can see that. Yeah. All right, so my favorite character, this is where I go back to the great Bill Moseley. The governor, to me, was probably the most interesting character just because he was Bill Moseley doing his best Bill Moseley. Great performance, very, you know, funny. And even though he was supposed to be a maniacal, like, you know, evil person, he was still very funny, you know, very animated. And I love Bill Moseley. I make no bones about it. One of my favorite actors to watch. And I've watched a ton of his stuff. And I just loved that character, even though he was, you know, very clearly the bad guy. But he was just so, you know, again, very, not, it's not the same performance, but it reminds me a lot of, like, you know, Texas Chainsaw 2. You know, when he's playing Chop Top and he's just being himself, and you can kind of tell that Sono Shion probably told these actors, just go out and do your thing. Right. And that's what Bill Moseley did. And I actually liked the governor, even though he's like the bad guy. I was kind of like, I like the governor. Like, he was so out there and funny that he kind of added that element to the movie for me. And to be fair, the governor was in the two halves of the movie that actually kind of made sense.
It's true, actually. He does bookend the movie very well. And it's Bill Moseley, so he's really charming. I think that's an easy pick for favorite character. Now, I figured he was going to be somewhere in your list, so I was like, I'm leaving Bill Moseley up to Damon. And I love Bill Moseley, too, by the way. I think he's great. And he gives a Bill Moseley-esque performance in this film. And before we move on, there was something that struck me funny in this movie. So, because we're talking about characters, Nicolas Cage, quite the character in this movie. And Psycho, his gunman for this bank heist that they did in his past, they're both progeny of really, really, like, historically relevant filmmakers.
Yeah.
And I thought it was funny that, if you don't know, Nicolas Cage is the nephew of Francis Ford Coppola, one of the more impressive directors of cinema history. And Nick Cassavetes is John Cassavetes' son, and John Cassavetes was an actor and an incredible director, revolutionary director in film, a big part of the American New Wave. And then I realized, like, these are two guys related to the greats, and they're in this absolute batshit movie together. There was just something funny about that contrast to me.
No, it is. Yeah, Nicolas Cage, of course, his real name is Nicolas Coppola. He changed his name. And then of course John Cassavetes should be very familiar with horror fans. His part in horror history should be well documented. So yeah, you're right. That is kind of odd and funny.
They're just, you know, these guys come from royalty, like cinema royalty, and they're in the weirdest fucking movies.
They are. All right, let's talk about best line because wow. Whew. Okay, so let me set this up and just be honest. You had the best line. Your line is also my best line, although I did pick another best line just so we'd have two.
Okay.
Set up your best line, which, again, is really the best line of this movie because, wow.
So Nick Cage is rallying the prisoners of the Ghostland, telling them that they don't have to be locked into this place, that they can actually go out there and they need to get out and they need to fight. And I think I'll leave it at that because the rest of the speech is going to speak for itself.
Oh, it definitely speaks. Here we go.
Now hear this! Ghostlanders! Tomorrow! Getting out of here!
Impossible!
It's impossible!
Impossible? Ha! If you had told me 3 days ago I'd be standing here with one arm and one... testicle! Trying to reason with you, bitches! I would have said impossible too, but I'm telling you, there's a way.
Very inspiring.
So, here's the question I have about that line. Did Nicolas Cage snort all the coke before that scene? Or did he inject it somehow into his veins? Because It was so over the top that he had to. There had to be. There's no way he did that sober.
There's no way he did more than one take of that. Unless he totally flubbed the line, which I doubt he did. It seems a little. It's a longer. There's actually way more to the speech, but I thought that was the most coherent part of the speech.
Coherency is a really strong word to use for this movie, Patrick.
Listen, take it with a grain of salt, but I was like, but in fact, he just goes, testicles! Like, what the fuck is going on? What is happening in this movie?
So, oh my best line also involves testicles, funny enough. Even though this is the best line, Nicolas Cage had the best line by far. Let me just be clear about that. But to pick something else, I decided to go with Bill Moseley. Earlier in the movie, after he basically pulls Nicolas Cage from his prison cell and outfits him with this leather outfit to go into the wasteland to find his quote unquote granddaughter, he gives him the rules about the explosives. And he tells about the explosives on his arms and the ones around his neck. And then he talks about the ones around his balls. I don't know a better way to say it. And this is Bill Moseley telling Nicolas Cage about the explosives around his nether regions.
Your trousers are also equipped with explosives, one at each testicule.
Butters.
Kintama. Boom.
Really?
I would have my Benice returned to me unsoiled, sir, so best mind your manners.
I just, when he said testicule, I couldn't. Testicule. yeah. So that was mine, even though, again, you really did have the best line. I'm just going to be honest.
I mean, it's funny that both of our best lines are testicular in nature.
Well, okay. So it's about to get. So people are going to really think I'm obsessed with Nicolas Cage's balls in a second because.
I think
the rest of our categories, I think like all of them, but maybe one involved that his testicles. So I'm spoiling a little bit of my picks here, but I'm just telling you ahead of time, like Nicolas Cage's balls really did take center stage for my picks in the best in these categories.
I also want to point something out before we get to that, because they trot him out of that jail cell and he's in like a sort of a traditional Japanese cloth underwear. Like if you've seen like,
sumo wrestlers.
What's that?
If you see like sumo wrestlers, that's what they wear.
Yeah, sumo wrestlers or sometimes you see like old festivals and like the guys are wearing a very specific cloth type under. So he's wearing that. And they're trotting him out into the town square for everyone to witness. And all the women are like way into him. And, you know, I get it. He's Nicolas Cage. He looks different than everybody else. He's a big dude and all that stuff. There is this one shot where like it's just the body. It's just the neck down. And the body is it's Nicolas Cage. It's supposed to be Nicolas Cage being trotted out. The body is muscular and like ripped. And then they cut back and it's clearly Nicolas Cage was using like a body double for that, just that one slice of a scene. And then they cut back to Nicolas Cage and they show most of his body. It's a totally different body. Did you see that?
I did catch that.
That's funny.
It's like, well, the editor must have been on like the cut list how much he was getting paid for this thing.
The editor must have been on the same shit everybody else was smoking.
Yeah, they mushrooms, whatever was going on over there. Prisoners of the Mushrooms. Let's talk about best gore, because while this is technically, again, we're talking about horror films, this is kind of a horror film. It's classified as a horror film. Yeah. There was a little bit of gore in this movie. So what was your best gore in Prisoners of the Ghostland?
My favorite gore came from the nuclear mutants and specifically Psycho, who was Nick Cage's old bank robbing partner from back in the day. I think his prison bus got sideswiped by a truck carrying nuclear waste, and that's what turned them into this. So Psycho's new form is sort of that of a like melted guy. Like he's rather melted. His eyes, so one of his eyes are like whited out. I just thought like, yeah, he looks fucked up. Like it wasn't, again, not bad production design, not bad makeup effects. Like he looked kind of crazy, like something out of a really well done trauma film.
Yeah, he did. He looked good. And like the face melting kind of reminded me a little bit of, RoboCop, in that scene where the guy gets hit with the toxic waste and he comes out and he's all like, that guy.
Yeah.
Kind of reminded me a little bit of that, like the melted face look. So yeah, I thought it was pretty strong makeup in the movie.
Yeah.
My best gore, once again, comes from Nicolas Cage's nuts. In the scene where basically the reason the explosives go off, and there's different reasons on his arms, is if he abuses or hits a woman, and then his balls are if he gets excited, basically gets, you know, hard on. I don't know a better way to say it. And at some point after he rescues Bernice, he decides to just suddenly get excited for some unknown reason, by the way. And the explosive blows off one of his nuts, and he literally holds it up and shows it in its bloody form. Now, I'm curious because there's a couple of these explosions in the film, one on his arm and one on his balls. Were these the least effective explosives of all time? Because, like, the one on his arm blows up, and it really doesn't blow off his arm. It just kind of, like, blows off a part of his arm. And yeah. Then the one on his balls doesn't actually blow up his nuts. It just blows the nut off.
Yeah, it was like it wasn't even like a firecracker worth of strength. That's what it seemed to me. Like, when these explosions went off, it was just like a little pop. And it popped one of his nuts right off
and
his
then
ball sack.
Nicolas Cage is holding up his bloody ball, and he's like, "Oh!" And I'm like, "Oh, Jesus!" So yeah, that was my best gore because
yeah,
when he got his nut blown off, that got me. So what about best kill? There were some kills, especially towards the end of this film. There was a pretty bloody ending to this movie. So what was your best kill?
My best performance, Yasujiro, the bodyguard of the governor, goes full 13 Assassins. And I don't know if anyone knows that reference. It's a great, it's an assassin movie by a horror legend, Takashi Miike, did a full blown samurai movie called 13 Assassins, where, you know, they just lay waste to anyone who gets in their way. And I really think, Damon, when I'm thinking about this now, And that's why it's my best kill, because it's just kind of a badass samurai scene. And this movie is half of a samurai movie. But I was thinking that, like, maybe the Yasujiro character, to me, he's the most the only other character that's built up to a certain level. I almost wonder if it was like they had Nicolas Cage for like 2 weeks and they had to just shoot. And I think they spent the rest of their time focused on Yasujiro. Did you get that vibe that, like, he was a little bit more focused?
A little bit. He seemed to be more of a central character than anybody else outside of the governor and Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, but he had rad sword skills, and he just lays waste to a bunch of cowboys and samurais. And I'm not quite sure why there was cowboys and samurais. I still don't understand why that was there.
I don't know that you're meant to understand, Patrick, to be completely honest. That was a cool scene, and him going, you know, wild in that scene was pretty cool. My best kill actually came a little bit in that same kind of sequence in the later film when Nicolas Cage and Sofia Boutella get back to town. Sofia Boutella, again, I think she's acting in a different movie than everybody else because she was very straightforward with her performance. And I'm saying that like as a compliment, like she was really good. She ends up getting attacked by a couple people, and she pulls out a samurai sword and gets into a fight. Kills a couple of guys, and this one dude looks over at her and goes, "Bitch," and like runs over to fight her, and she kills him and then slits his throat. And then when she pulls, it's a really cool, I tell you what, probably my favorite moment in the movie, honestly, is when she slits his throat with the sword and then kind of walks away and just see the blood splatter fly out from his neck. Yeah. That was probably like, that would be a scene. Like, I would like a gif of that. Like, I would like that little clip. Cause that was really cool. Cause she like slices his throat and then walks away with a sword in her hand. Like, and as he's falling down behind her, you see all the blood splatter just flying out of his neck.
Yeah. The big arterial spray that you would see in like an anime or in Quentin Tarantino's, Kill Bill, like just spraying blood like in an impossibly big way, but it is super dramatic and cool and interesting.
Yeah, very, very, very interesting. Okay, so let's get into the two most important categories of this entire episode, which are what we have officially dubbed "What the Fuck." What is your best "What the Fuck" moment in this movie?
Yeah, as you can tell, folks, we asked that question of ourselves a lot while watching this movie. I asked the question, are these people insane? Am I insane? What's going on? Like, there are a lot of questions in this movie. My biggest question was, Damon mentioned just a moment ago, these tiny little bombs, these little baby bombs that go off on Nicolas Cage's suit. One of them blows his arm off, but it doesn't blow his arm off. It like blows a hole in his forearm, and Nicolas Cage is kind of a big guy. So I would guess the wound for him would have been maybe a doctor's visit, you know, like that kind of level of wound. But they treat it in the movie like his arm has been blown away. So they fashion him as you would in a cyberpunk post-apocalyptic world, like sort of a metal arm. But Damon, the metal arm has a giant like wound on it, like where it got blown off. And I was like, why does the metal arm have a wound on it?
I have no idea.
It was a big bloody wound, like that they had to also bandage up. And I go, if we're giving him a robo arm, can't we skip the wound?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't understand it.
Yeah. So, I'm kind of cheating here because our next category is called the best Nick Cage moment, because this is very much a Nick Cage performance. So I've actually got two best what the fuck and best Nick Cage moment. I'm going to talk about both of them here if you don't mind, and then I'll allow you to go to your best Nick Cage moment. So my best what the fuck moment is what I've already talked about, which is technically also kind of my best Nick Cage moment, but I have a separate one for that. The what the fuck moment, it goes back to what I said earlier. What the fuck was going on with him jumping out of the car and riding the bike? I know we already kind of discussed this, and I know I kind of buried the lead, already talked about it, but I'm still confounded by the bizarre sequence of events that leads to him driving, jumping out of the car like he's going to get caught, jumping on a bike, and then just feverishly pedaling down the street. And then I think it's Yoshijiro shows up with the car, and basically, and Nicolas Cage says something like, oh, it's going to be a long ride or something weird like that, and then jumps back in the car.
Yeah.
That was, to me, like, that is the clearest definition of what this movie is for me, because when that happened, I'm just like, what in the fuck is going on here?
I would love to say, like, I would love to, like, try and guess, oh, like, maybe they did that to fill time. This movie's over time. It's not, like, under 90 minutes.
Yeah.
So it was like, you didn't even need that scene necessarily. I just don't know what it was for. Like he just, he darts out of there in that Toyota Celica, screeches to a halt, rushes over to grab a little girl's bike, get on it, pedal furious like a madman, like on all the cocaine, and then they stop him 10 seconds later and go, no, you have to get in the car. And he goes, okay, I'll get in the car.
Yeah, it's just like so weird. He's just like, oh, I guess I need the car. And I'm just like, what just happened? Why did we do that? Why? What was it? And again, I'm all for, I understand their symbolism. What was the symbolism in that? Like, don't buy a Peloton? Like, I don't know what the symbolism was there. I don't know.
In a movie full of nutty things, it was the one thing where I was like, this doesn't go in here at all.
It's funny you say nutty, because my second what the fuck Nick Cage moment, I'm just gonna say it right now. Here it is.
One. Testicle!
Did you miss that? Hold on, let me.
Testicle!
Hold on. Did you understand that, Patrick? Nicolas Cage, in his most Nicolas Cage moment.
One. Testicle!
That's it. That's my Nicolas Cage moment. When you go, testicle!
And that's what everybody's there for, right? If we're honest, like I think the fans that like watch all these Nicolas Cage movies, they're looking for that moment, and he gives it to you in that moment. That's like a 100% Nicolas Cage moment.
I feel like I need to stand in like the middle of Whole Foods or something and just stop, look up, and go, Testicle!
That's great. It is. It is the defining Nicolas Cage moment in the movie. Mine is less so, but so, and again, it revolves around his testicles. I don't understand. It must have been in the script. So when he finally finds Sophia Boutella's character, Bernice, she's like catatonic, and she seems to be locked in this kind of state. And he tries to get her to drink some water, and he's like pouring water in her mouth. It's not sexual in any way, shape, or form. And I guess the implication is that he was in prison, so maybe he's like a little hard up for action or something like that. But like, so I can tell that that's a script thing. It had nothing. I don't think Nicolas Cage had a ton of input. I mean, I know he does these movies because he can do his thing, and the directors don't stop him. That's usually why he does these. But like, how he gets to being like turned on made no fucking sense, and it's wacky as shit. And like, he's pouring the water in his mouth. He's like, yeah, yeah, baby, you like that? Yeah. And all of a sudden he's like, and then the beeping starts and he has to back up because his nut is about to explode. And you're like, what the fuck is happening here? It is a what the fuck moment as well as a Nick Cage moment.
You know what he lost in that moment, don't you?
One. Testicle!
Just saying.
I was going to say his chance at winning an Oscar this year.
Yeah.
Because that, these both came out in the same calendar year.
They did. Yeah, that was a weird one. Like, it was erotic, and it's just like, why? I don't, whatever. But yeah, it was, yeah,
again,
it was
weird. That was a script problem, but Nick Cage solved it in a Nick Cage way.
Script problem. That's funny. I feel like this entire movie is full of script solutions, let me tell you. Let's talk about the final categories we do each and every week here on the show. I think this is going to be an interesting one. Is it scary? Now, Patrick, I said this a million times on the show. I am all for inclusion. I don't want people to look at a film and say, oh, that's not a horror film. There's some gore in this movie, and there's some real weird sequences, and there's some pretty cool kills. So I guess by that definition alone, and you are in a dystopian wasteland, so by that definition, you are a bit of a horror film. But I'm not, I think this is more sci-fi than horror, but there are horror elements. So when I ask you, is it scary? It sounds like a very loaded question, because you can probably tell from our conversation, there wasn't anything really scary about this movie.
No, I don't think this is a scary movie. However, if you dropped a lot of acid and you put this movie on and you did not know what you were getting into, I think it would scare the shit out of you.
I feel like this is one of those films where I would just be like, you know what? I've never, like, if you're a pretty straight laced person, you know, maybe you've done a couple of things, you're not too crazy, but you're like, I've always wanted to try mushrooms. This is the film for you. Like, you need to just, you know, knock down a couple fungi and sit down and watch this movie, because it is that kind of experience. It is, or maybe you are like straight edge or just don't want to do drugs, or you're just, you know,
right.
I'm totally fine with that too. Whatever, you know, whatever floats your boat. If you want to know what it's like to do mushrooms and you want to know what it's like to do LSD and acid, and listen, I'm not a big drug guy, but I'm not saying I haven't done some things in my lifetime. Sure. This is pretty much that experience. Like, if you just want to sit down and understand what mushrooms feel like, watch Prisoners of the Ghostland.
I think that's great advice, actually. If you don't want to do drugs, but you want to see what it looks like through the lens of somebody who's on all the drugs, watch Prisoners of the Ghostland.
Oh, there. I think like half the budget for this movie was for hair dye and mushrooms.
That's crazy. This movie's insane. I gotta say, you know, Nicolas Cage does not disappoint, right? If you sign up for a late stage Nicolas Cage movie, you're gonna get one with Prisoners of the Ghostland.
Let me tell you right now, Patrick, and I'll say this in all honesty, I'll watch anything Nicolas Cage does. I can't say that I'm gonna go back and watch this again, but the fact that I will forever have
one testicle
makes it all worthwhile that I watch this movie.
All jokes aside, Damon, I can't wait to go watch like Color Out of Space and Willy's Wonderland. Like, it makes me want to see more weird Nicolas Cage shit.
Yeah, I love it. I love it, dude. Do more. I hope he does more.
I hope he spends the rest of his career doing horror films. We're lucky to have him.
100%. All right. That's our show for this week. Prisoners of the Ghostland, currently available from our friends over at Shudder.
Shudder.
And you can watch it over there right now. It is an experience. Let's put it that way.
Hey, by the way, while we're talking about avant-garde stuff on Shudder, I do want to give a quick shout out. One of my favorite bands, Boy Harsher, has a 40-minute film on there, which is essentially a music video for their whole new album that's coming out, called The Runner. If you're into weird, if we're talking about weird experimental shit, we might as well talk about that too. Check that out. It's on Shudder. I think it's exclusively on Shudder. So if you have Shudder, you can see The Runner by Boy Harsher. Cool little experimental film by one of my favorite bands. The music's awesome.
Yeah, so there you go. But yeah, check out Prisoners of the Ghostland. I think Mandy, I'm pretty sure Mandy's also on Shudder. I think Color Out of Space.
Color Out of Space is for sure.
Is on Shudder. Maybe even Willy's Wonderland. I'm not 100% sure. It feels like Shudder's kind of the home for Nicolas Cage and his like second stage. So yeah, you check out all his. And again, when I say like, we've heard a lot of us saying like, this is so weird, so bizarre. I feel like I want more people to watch this so I can share that experience with them.
Yes.
Like I want to talk to people about. I'm gonna start like when I go to my next horror movie convention, I'm just gonna walk up to people like, have you seen Prisoners of the Ghostland? Do you want to talk about it?
You're gonna be that guy.
I'm gonna be that guy because I'm just like, have you seen it? Do you want to talk about it?
Help me.
Do you have some mushrooms? Yeah. So big thank you, of course, to everyone tuning in to the show each and every week. Make sure you check us out on all your favorite podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Amazon Podcast, Amazon Music, excuse me. It's anywhere and everywhere. I dumped our podcast on a million different platforms a couple of weeks ago. So if you have a podcast player or a podcast service you are a fan of, chances are you will find Rewind of the Living Dead on there. As always, if you've got questions, comments, movies you'd like us to review, please hit us up on Twitter anytime. You can find me at Damon Martin, and you are?
At Director Patrick.
And you can also find us from email. Email us your questions. Email us your comments. You can email us at rotlivingdead@gmail.com. That's rotlivingdead@gmail.com. We'll see you guys next week for another edition of Rewind of the Living Dead. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you then.
Peace.